And our special guest now tonight, William Henry. He's an investigative mythologist. We're going to talk about Atlantis. We're going to catch up with some past conversations with William as well. So get ready for this coast-to-coast ride. We'll be back. William Henry is an investigative mythologist, author of numerous books on ancient mythology and neo-archaeology with a Stargate kind of twist. By applying the latest theories in science and consciousness to ancient myths of the gates of the illumined gods, including Sumerian, Egyptian, and Holy Grail gateway myths, he hopes to uncover the secrets guarded by such groups as the Illuminati. His latest DVD is called Stargate 2012, linking the Atlantis myth with modern wormhole theories, and states that we are on the verge of rediscovering the God's sacred science of uniting heaven and earth. And William, I hope we do the reuniting of heaven and earth sooner than later. How are you, my friend?
Ah, terrific, George. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Good. What have you been doing since we last chatted?
Oh, I've been busy. One of the big highlights of my summer, I went to France and had a wonderful tour with a group of Coptic folks from Michigan. It was a phenomenal time and got some really hardcore research done, which I'm really excited about.
What'd you do in France now? But you had been there before for a trip, a year before that, right?
That's correct, yes. Thanks for remembering. Yeah. We did the usual tour going into Paris, Chartres Cathedral, on down to Rennes-le-Château, except on this trip we made a very special detour to a way-off-the-beaten-path village called Dom, which is a quote-unquote lost village in the Dordogne Valley that practically no one's ever heard of, but there were some researchers in the 80s named Ayan and Dyke Begg who had written a book called In Search of the Holy Grail and the Precious Blood, and they described this kind of bizarre graffiti found in the chateau at Dom where Knights Templar had been imprisoned during their surprise attack in 1307. And this graffiti portrayed a really unusual set of symbols. It showed a pregnant woman holding a rod or a wand. It showed a crucifixion scene, and that's all I knew, and I had never seen a photo of it, and so I was really dying to get there. It's like, imagine, you know, what are we talking about here? A pregnant woman holding a rod or wand at the crucifixion.
And knowing you, you've got to see these pictures, because I know the way you hunt for those.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that you really learn right off the bat, is that very often if you're in a book and you see an image, you want to know what's on the left of it, the right of it, above it, below it, because that's what really tells the whole story. So I had been imagining this, what this graffiti might have looked like. And then when I got there, I was just absolutely flabbergasted to see that these Templars had inscribed within the stone a perfect Sephirotic tree of life, the Kabbalistic tree of life. This is really important because you have numerous researchers that say that the Templars had all kinds of Gnostic knowledge, or they had this knowledge that the Illuminati had been seeking or had been preserving, and it is what enabled them to become the advanced beings that many purport them to have been, but you never see direct evidence of it. You never see it in any of the Templar books or anything. Well, here it is. And by the way, my analysis of this Templar graffiti at Dom has made the cover story of Atlantis Rising this month. People can, Coast listeners can download it for free at atlantisrising.com, or I've got it on the front page of my site, williamhenry.net. And you can see this amazing imagery, because, and it gets even more amazing than that, because in addition to this tree of life that clearly indicates that they possessed this ancient Jewish mystic knowledge, we also see, and this is so wild, what we see is an image that almost precisely matches the Dagon tribe's landing of the craft of a figure they called Namo, which was this sort of fish god that matches so many other fish gods throughout the ancient world.
Well, they're the ones who believe some extraterrestrials came down from the Sirius star system, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, what in the world is this doing accompanying this crucifixion imagery at Dom, and what are the Knights Templar doing exemplifying that in their in their artwork here, and it's the start of a new path of Templar research here, because we know that the Templars were in Jerusalem, we know that they were likely in Egypt, but we didn't know that they were mixing with the Dagon tribe or that they had assimilated some of their beliefs yet. Here it is in their symbolism that they etched onto the wall of this chateau.
That story of the Dagon tribe is, to me, one of the most remarkable stories I've ever heard, William, in terms of how they had knowledge of a star system that you couldn't see with the naked eye. And, I mean, it was just incredible with what they were able to do.
Oh, it was such purity, too. And whenever I talk about the Dagon tribe, I have to mention there's an author named Laird Scranton who has a book called Hidden Meanings, which is a study of the Dagon symbolism. And he's an author that John Anthony West has been working with and carefully shepherding. And you'll be hearing from Laird soon, I'm sure, because his book is just absolutely astounding in his analysis of the Dagon tribe and linking it with modern science. So I hope that we...
Well, I want him, so you get him for me, okay?
Okay. I'll do it.
Turn you... Hey, when I found out that you were doing work on Atlantis, I mean, I was just thrilled to death, because that is one subject I just can't get enough of. Tell me a little bit about your overview, first of all, and your interest with Atlantis.
Well, of course, it's the end and the beginning of all myths, in a sense. I mean, all roads seem to lead to Atlantis, or to what we call the new Atlantis in terms of prophecy. And it's just such an alluring story because it has so many gaps in it, but yet it has so many clues to something magnificent that went on in the ancient world. I mean, and if I were giving you the Hollywood pitch on this story, it would be the story of a high civilization founded by the gods who came to Earth, who mated with humankind, and built a temple enclosure, in fact, a shrine for the offspring of the gods. But then through the course of time, this divine essence that the gods possessed was diluted, and the civilization fell and suffered a cataclysm. And now the third act of this story is the long march to reclaim this once advanced civilization and allow humankind to once again dwell in what we call the New Atlantis, or what's referred to in the Bible as the New Jerusalem.
Yeah, sounds a little like Plato, too, doesn't it?
Well, that's where the story originated, was with Plato in 400 B.C., exactly.
What did he know? How did he know? Did this come from myth? Did it come from stories handed down from father to son or mother to daughter? How did Plato hold on to this? And did anybody else write about Atlantis afterward, William, or was it just Plato?
Well, actually, yes, a lot of people did write about Atlantis, including the Aztecs and the Mayas. They called it Aztlan or Atlan, or its sacred name Tula, which is a word we can talk about in a moment. But to answer your question, Plato received the story from Egypt. It's claimed that he was initiated in the great mysteries of Egypt at the age of 49. And this is kind of the style of the way the Atlantis story is presented. It simply says that he was initiated in these mysteries of Egypt, although it does not say exactly what those mysteries were. It's sort of like the way we're told that Moses was trained in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. And I guess we're supposed to fill in with our imagination and suggest that that means he knows who built the Sphinx and why, who built the Great Pyramids and how, and all of the other matters about the temples of ancient Egypt.
I guess if other civilizations have mentioned Atlantis in either a direct or roundabout way, one has to assume that something happened to a highly advanced civilization. Exactly what, of course, we can debate, but to me it sounds like some kind of earth calamity, but that this region, wherever it may be, truly existed. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, it's my belief that our ability to grasp the importance of the Atlantis myth to current events is only matched by our ability to absorb the astounding when we think of the ancient world, that how advanced do we want to make this civilization? We're talking about a civilization founded by the quote-unquote gods who were in contact with a wisdom center at the center of the universe, where in the Atlantis story the god Zeus dwelled. Now, I'm of the belief and of an axis of researchers that really was inspired by Dr. Paula Violette that believes that the center of the universe referred to in Plato's story is in fact the center of our galaxy, the center of the Milky Way. And so it suggests that we have a civilization here on Earth where advanced beings dwelled who were also in contact with a wisdom center, another wisdom center at the center of our Milky Way.
And how was that communication? Do we know?
Well, no, we don't know for certain, although Plato does give us a clue in that humankind, the offspring, rather, of the mating of the gods and humans, the hybrid humans, were inspired, if you will, through what appears to me to sound like mental telepathy in Plato's account. And so it suggests that there was some kind of a telepathic link, a form of consciousness that united perhaps Earth with the galactic center, but which certainly united the people of Earth. And it's through this telepathic mental communication that they were able to stay in contact with one another.
The Bible, of course, has some tremendous clues of a lot of different things. Is there anything in there that would lead you to believe that Atlantis was put in the Bible?
Well, when the race of Atlanteans lost their quote-unquote divine essence, this is what brought about the wrath of the god Zeus, and this is what triggered the cataclysm of Atlantis. So it appears to have been a premeditated cataclysm. There was foreknowledge that it was going to occur. But to answer your question here, this wrath of Zeus equates with the reasons given in the book of Genesis for God sending Noah's flood upon mankind. We had simply gone too far off the path. Our divine essence had been diluted. And as a consequence, it was time for a cleansing to occur. Now, it's not just the Bible that refers to this cataclysm and the divine essence. There's another set of books called the Gnostic text from the early 2nd to 4th century. And in that collection of books, there's one particular text called the Hypostasis of the Archons, which is also called the Reality of the Rulers. And in that book, it also describes a group of beings called Archons who seek to possess this divine essence that's within humankind. They don't have it. We do. They want to take it from us. And the crazy thing about this is that these Archons resemble what we would today call the Greys, extraterrestrial race. Yes.
That's a great story. And all of that is laid out in ancient mythology or ancient texts.
Yes, that story I just described about the Archons is in this early Gnostic Christian text called the Hypostasis of the Archons. I wrote about it in my book, Oracle of the Illuminati, and I even put pictures in there that I downloaded from the Baghdad Museum of what we think these Archons look like, and they are clearly some form of, they look just like Greys, George.
Could they be the vivid imagination of the author of the day?
They very well could be. I mean, there's no question that when we're talking about Atlantis, we're talking about a creation myth, just like the book of Genesis is a creation myth. And in that sense, we are definitely talking about the possibility of this simply being a story that is susceptible to many levels of interpretation, including the historical, but especially the metaphorical and the allegorical. To use a modern word, Atlantis is what we call a meme, spelled M-E-M-E, meme, which is a catch-all phrase for a code symbol. America is a meme. America is a place name, but it's also a mental program, a matrix or a realm of possibility, as well as a spiritual goal. And that's exactly what the word or meme Atlantis is. It's a program, a realm of possibility, as well as a spiritual goal.
The Bible writes about Noah's flood.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from the dates, you know, Noah's flood being, 5,000 B.C., something like that?
Give or take a few.
Is it possible that we may be talking about the same thing, Noah's flood that's in the Bible, the sinking of Atlantis, which may have occurred from an asteroid or who knows what. Is it possible that these are the same stories?
Well, it's quite possible, too, but we have to remind ourselves that Plato actually claimed that there had been several cataclysms throughout the past. And he says exactly that, coming from his ancestor, that the Greeks are all children, and you have no belief rooted in old tradition. And the reason is this, is because there have been and will be many different calamities to destroy mankind, the greatest of them by fire and by water.
Well, let's talk about what might have happened to Atlantis, William. Based on your research, what's your best guess?
My best guess is based upon, again, the research of Dr. Paula Violette, that a cyclical event destroys humankind through a terrible cataclysm. It's called a galactic superwave, which is LaViolette's term for an intense volley of cosmic rays that come from the center of our galaxy when it explodes periodically. And what we find when this happens, we have the arrival of an electromagnetic pulse and later a gravity wave that triggers tsunamis, earthquakes, volcanic eruptions. And also, and here's the real crux of our contemporary time, it also triggers problems with the sun. And I've been following, for example, the newsletter put out by Mitch Batros, the Earth Changes TV newsletter, he's documenting in a very almost frightening way the problems that we're having with the sun right now, and that it's quite possible that Hurricane Katrina and the intense volley of hurricanes we've had the past year are coming from problems from the sun. But that originates from, in LaViolette's model, from a galactic superwave event emanating from the center of the Milky Way galaxy.
Well, you know, you may be right, William, because something is heating up these oceans, whether they're underground volcanoes, global warming, or it's a cycle, but it could very well be something from the sun as well.
Well, and the BBC News just put out a report yesterday that global warming is currently happening on Mars, too.
Yeah.
NASA reported that the deposits of frozen carbon dioxide near the planet's South Pole have shrunk three summers in a row.
They've had some gullies that have just occurred, they said.
Yeah.
That they were not there several years ago.
Right. And so these changes suggest that climate change is happening now on Mars.
Well, these Atlanteans, as their continent was sinking, as the landmass was sinking, they fled. They escaped, didn't they, some of them?
Yes.
Where'd they go?
Central Asia. They went to portions of South America, we are told. At least this is where they re-inhabited their civilization. There's wonderful research being done by folks like Greg Little down in the Yucatan that are right on the edge of finding what they think is a Yucatan Hall of Records prophesied by Edgar Cayce, and lo and behold, there it is. So those are two primary locations. I'm focusing a lot of my attention on the Central Asia region, especially Mongolia, a region that is called by the mystic name Shambhala. Spent a lot of years researching a figure named Nicholas Rurik, who went in search of the secrets of the Holy Grail in Shambhala, because it is claimed that a hidden directorate that operates behind the scenes of humanity operates from Shambhala in Central Asia, and their lineage is traced all the way back to Atlantis. And so that's a very key bit of research right there for me.
All right, William's website, by the way, is williamhenry.net. Okay, williamhenry.net. And we'll be back in a moment with William Henry. He's got a very fascinating story about Cherokee Indian mythology. We'll talk about that as we search for Atlantis. And also, next hour, if you have a computer, get ready to look at some of these images that William has supplied us, and we're going to go through them next hour. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, William Henry, our guest, right here on Coast to Coast AM. William, tell us a little bit about this Cherokee Indian. Was it a mythology? Was it a real story about what they talked about the extraterrestrials?
Right. I'm recounting a Cherokee Indian creation mythology that was documented by Diane Wehu in her book, Voices of Our Ancestors. She's a 27th generation Cherokee Indian storyteller. And so what we're being told is that this story that we're about to discuss has been passed along for 27 generations, excuse me, and it was kept secret until 1969 when we landed on the moon. And the essential story is that the Cherokee believed that they were created by beings of light called TLA beings, which stands for a word called Tula, an ancient name for Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
These beings of light came from the Pleiades through what may be described as a vortex or a hole in space over East Tennessee, Oak Ridge area, where we built the world's first nuclear reactor. And there they created the Cherokee to guard one of 12 gates of energy that surround the planet.
In your research, William, how prevalent is extraterrestrial life as opposed to dimensional life? You know, we've talked about the stargates and the wormholes and things like that. Are we talking about two separate things, or are they all tied together?
I think they're all tied together, George, because while we see gods, and I go into this in detail in my DVD, Stargates of the Gods and Stargate 2012,
right.
I have a whole catalog of images from the ancient world that portray gods flying in craft. And I prefer to call them craft because the description of them is this, that shows the gods in a ring that has wings. And when we look at this, our knee-jerk reaction is to say, oh, well, this is these are the chariots of the gods. This is Eric von Däniken's UFOs. But then when we look into the stories that accompany such imagery, we find out that the gods aren't, in fact, flying in craft. They're in what are called Merkaba vehicles, space-time light vehicles that have more of an interdimensional quality. In addition to that, these gods, some of them have a chakra or a ring in their hand. So not only are they flying within a ring that is winged, but they have a ring in their hand, and that ring is called the Ring of Cosmic Sovereignty. And what that says to me is that these beings are free to come and go and travel anywhere that they like. And the way that they do this is through these interdimensional vehicles that transport them through gateways.
Now, the Tula, that ancient name for Atlantis that you just mentioned, it had some effect on you too, did it?
It did. I mean, it's my magic word, I call it. I first encountered it back in 1990. I was, at that time, trying to get my writing career going, and I had been doing research for a gentleman, reading books for a living for him, and then that job ended, and next thing I know, here comes Ted Turner, founder of CNN, with a literary contest. He said that science and technology can't solve the world's problems, and he offered $500,000 for the best piece of fiction that discusses themes for the survival and prosperity of all life on the planet. And so I was researching and doing a fictional work for that contest, which I entered. And by the way, so did James Redfield. He entered the Celestine Prophecy. He didn't win either. But what I found is, or what my proposal was, is that if we're going to make any difference in this world, we have to start with the children. We have to begin to re-educate them or allow them to show us a way to build this ideal civilization. So I had created a place that was shaped like an egg with butterfly wings and a heart-shaped head, thinking that those three symbols, the egg, the wings, and the heart, would best exemplify it, an advanced kind of civilization these children could build. And I needed a name for the place. And one night, I had gone to see Randy Winter's video presentation on the Pleiadians. in which he showed those amazing photographs that Billy Meyer was supposed to have taken in Switzerland of the of the Pleiadian beam craft, which are astounding, right? And I remember driving home after that event, looking up at the stars and for the first time saying, wait a minute, these lights that I see in the blackness of space, those aren't two-dimensional lights. There's three-dimensional space beyond that. And it was a really kind of mind-expanding moment. So I got home that night, and I stood on my back porch, and I said, okay, you know, Pleiadians, if you guys are real and you're communicating with us, give me a name for my academy for these kids. And the word Tula popped into my mind.
And there it was.
And there it was. And I thought I'd made the name up, like Haagen-Dazs or Sony, and thought it was something new. And so I enter the contest, and of course I don't win. But then I start doing research.
Did you get a letter from them? Anything?
No, nothing.
Nothing.
Oh, in fact, you know, it was kind of a bummer at the end of it, because William Styron was one of the judges, so was Ray Bradbury. And they both said that the book that won didn't deserve to win. So I'm thinking, well, if you guys were the judges and you're saying the book that won didn't deserve to win, something's wrong here.
We know Bradbury. We should send him one of your books and say, what do you think of this guy?
Yeah. So to finish the story, I just started doing research and found out that Tula actually existed in the ancient world. It was the most sacred name for Atlantis. It was the name of the center of Atlantis. And in fact, the Druids claimed it's the name of the center of the galaxy.
That's interesting. The technology that was on Atlantis must have been absolutely astounding.
Well, we would think so, absolutely. And the reason that we can claim that is by the symbols of the technology that's been left behind and passed down through the generations.
And what are the odds, though, William, of an area that may have been the most technologically advanced ever, maybe even more so than us today, and that area goes, in all these other regions, nothing happened to them? I mean, isn't that strange all by itself?
Very, very definitely. And then I also find it kind of interesting that many, for example, people believe that the Atlanteans then went into Egypt. Well, a lot of Egyptologists reject that notion. And in fact, you find many traditions rejecting the Atlantean concept. So that's kind of interesting, too.
Do you think they did, that they went into Egypt?
I don't have direct evidence. I'm going back to Egypt in March of 2006 with Freddie Silva. And I've got some research to follow up on in terms of following the trail that we're talking about tonight. So maybe I'll have some new information about that next year.
I mean, there's just no question that the technology of the Egyptians, of the Central Americans, the Incas, the Mayans, there's got to be some shared technology here. They may have been all part of the same people.
Quite possibly, and are definitely drawing from the same wisdom well, because we see so many of the same symbols appearing over and over again, and that to me is the way that we can track the continuation of the Atlantean meme, if you will.
You know, after the tsunami December 26th, and then what Hurricane Katrina did to New Orleans, I sometimes try to sit back and picture what it would have been like to be on Atlantis when whatever happened to them occurred. I think it was fast. And then, of course, thousands of years later, they got hit with more, and then the whole thing submerged. But I think, you know, just by watching the tsunami, watching Hurricane Katrina, we might have been witnesses to what happened to Atlantis.
That's exactly right, and that's why I wanted to come on and share this moment with you here, because it does give us this rare opportunity, a horrifying glimpse of what the awesome destruction of Atlantis must have looked like. And, you know, again, we have this image that Atlantis disappeared in a single day and night. But then you have others that came along. For example, Francis Bacon says that no, it actually took almost 100 years for the demise of the civilization. And so, gosh, you know, take your pick. Would you rather go down in one night or a very slow cataclysm that takes many decades. And unfortunately, it looks like that's the direction we're headed in unless we can take some steps to forestall that cataclysm.
You know, I'd want to go down in a slow way, and I'll tell you why, William. To me, there's always hope, and there's always this positiveness that you could surround yourself with and that you can always fight. And if something happens so swiftly, you never had a chance, that would be disappointing. But if we have time to fight the ills that are out there, whatever they may be, that's the direction I'd like to go.
Well, I agree. In fact, that's the kind of the opportunity that we have here. This is, I believe, truly a golden moment for humanity because we have a chance right now to make permanent a new state of consciousness that you might, that the alchemists called the Philosopher's Stone, that has other names. But what it starts with is a marriage of the opposites. And that's our problem. One of our main problems right now is the opposites in our world, the imbalance between rich and poor, especially. I mean, the UN used to give numbers a couple of years ago that over half the world's population doesn't have a toilet and is 2.5 days walk from the nearest telephone.
You know what? We take these things for granted, don't we?
Absolutely. And that imbalance is what has to be healed. And in my view, the only way we heal that is we have to bring in a third higher force that balances the two. It's a new spiritual energy as well as a desire that has to come into this world. And, you know, I also believe we have the technology, George, because you have so many people talking about, well, you know, the Hurricane Katrina and perhaps even the tsunami is an example of a secret weather war.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if we have the ability to control a hurricane, which is hundreds of times more powerful than a hydrogen bomb, then we are classified as what Michio Kaku would call a type 1 civilization. That means that we have the capability, the technology to solve all our problems. What we lack at present is the motivation to use this technology for peaceful purpose. And that's why I say we're on the verge of rediscovering the God's sacred science of uniting heaven and earth, because, again, a civilization that has tapped its resources but does not have the technology to control its planetary resources and still derives its energy from fossil fuels and coal is going nowhere. But a type 1 civilization that can control the energy resources of its planet and can control the weather, as is being proposed right now, can prevent earthquakes, can harvest the oceans, can explore its solar system, and is on the verge of becoming a civilization that we would call actually advanced.
Well, I'm here, of course, in St. Louis. You are in Nashville, right?
Yes.
And then, of course, we've got this New Orleans connection. But you talk about some kind of prophecy that relates to these three cities.
Yes. In The Keys of Enoch, Dr. J.J. Hertog describes new cities of light that are going to emerge at the time of the millennium right now. And he calls this the anointing of the dove, or an area, a region called the dove, that is laid over the United States. The central axis of this complex goes right, begins through the Yucatan, goes straight through New Orleans and straight up through St. Louis. You can virtually draw a line on Interstate 55,
mm-hmm.
and that becomes the central axis of this dove region. And in the book, which is a prophecy given to him by Enoch, the biblical figure who ascended to the heavens in a whirlwind and walked with the gods, he claims that Nashville, Tennessee is going to be one of the primary repositories of light. Now, this is a place where we're going to see advanced knowledge emerge, perhaps even advanced knowledge that was one time prevalent within Atlantis or other high advanced civilizations. And lo and behold, what we have in St. Louis is Cahokia Mound,
yes.
which is a very special place. And here in Nashville, we've got a duplicate of the Parthenon from ancient Greece, and we've also got a 2,200-foot-long magician's rod that is laid out at the base of our state capitol.
they are still finding things at Cahokia Mounds right now that they never knew existed. Much more than, you know, originally they thought it was just a mound of, you know, an Indian burial ground or a place of worship, and it was just all dirt, you know, piled high. Now they're beginning to see structures within it with the kind of machinery and technology that they have. I think if they ever really investigate it, William, they may find some secrets there.
Oh, I definitely think so, and I'm taking a cue on this from Thomas Jefferson, who was deeply, deeply interested in the mounds of ancient America. We call them mounds because you can't say the word pyramid in America, but that's what the Cahokia Mound is. It's a pyramid whose base is larger than the Great Pyramid of Giza. And so what we have here is an ancient civilization that inhabited these regions, Nashville, St. Louis, and even down into the Louisiana, New Orleans region, and it's the records are still there. The knowledge of those civilizations is still there, and I've been making a study of the symbols of what they call them, the Mississippian people, the Mississippian era. When we go into the Tennessee State Museum here in Nashville, they have examples of their plates, their pottery, their symbols that we see on this pottery. It's all Anunnaki symbols. You can't tell the difference between the stuff that's on the plates here in Nashville and the stuff they're pulling out of the ground in Iraq.
I know. That is strange. It really is. When we come back at the top of the hour, William, let's go through some of the pictures and graphics that you sent us, okay? And then I'll have you explain what they are.
Love to. Thank you, George.
Now, who created them? Was that Dana? Did Dana do that?
Yes, Dana Augustine created the image we call the New Atlantis that's on the coast-to-coast site as the masthead. And a couple others are actually several hundred years old. And I've got another piece of art done by Jack Andrews from Tucson, Arizona, that's quite remarkable as well.
Okay, we're going to look at seven plates, at least initially.
Great.
Called Atlantis Plate 1 through 7, and we'll have William explain what they are because they have a lot to do with his presentation today. And I'm telling you, you look at these pictures, you can see wormholes and everything else. I mean, they knew something a long time ago, didn't they? I'm George Norrie, back in a moment. William Henry on Coast to Coast AM.